Hello, hello, and welcome to the Thin Blue Mind. Each week we will be looking at current policing issues and topics within the UK. Our regular panel consists of Steve Bradshaw, who is a TV and theatre actor, Richard Horton, author, and me, Dave Thomas, broadcaster. What we all have in common is over 80 years of combined police service. Now retired, we will be providing opinion and insights from the unique position of having been there and done it. Steve spent the majority of his service on firearms before being promoted to inspector, where he was a force incident manager. Richard was a career detective before going back into uniform as a response sergeant. Myself, I spent the majority of my service on the Rhodes Policing Unit before going into CID and Child Protection. You may not agree with everything we say, but we will make you think.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion.
Well, hello, hello, and welcome to this week's episode of The Thin Blue Mind. This week we're going to be looking at the HMIC FRS report into the police's response to burglary, robbery and other acquisitive crime. It's subtitled Finding Time for the Crime. Now, there was two main recommendations made from that report, was that giving victims timely and appropriate advice during their initial calls and to conduct risk assessments for repeated victims, and also ensure that robberies and burglaries and serious acquisitive crime are subject to investigation, supervision and direction, making sure supervisors have capability to meaningfully supervise, making sure investigators meet the necessary standard and applying investigative codes appropriately and complying with the victim's code of practice. Richard, I know you've had a scan through the report. What were your standouts?
Well, the things you've mentioned, obviously giving time to the victim to give them a proper service and better supervision or better trained supervision and better supervision generally of those sort of investigations for serious and acquisitive crime. They also mentioned that there's a lack of capacity. They didn't necessarily go too far into why there's a lack of capacity in policing to deal with SAC crimes. And they also mentioned inadequate digital forensic capability. Something we've mentioned before in this blog, the bottleneck around digital forensics, the lack of sufficient experts that can go before court and give forensic and digital evidence. Taking together all of those things means that it's very arguable, and I think it's right, that we're not giving a proper service to victims of theft, victims of burglary, victims of street crime. And we're just giving them we'll get to you when we can, and perhaps you'll see a bobby in 3 days, or perhaps you'll have to give your report to us over the phone. That can't be right.
It can't be right, no, and I agree with you. I actually welcome this report. I think it lays bare everything that every cop knows, I think, that we can't get to these offences, or we become de-skilled. But I'm unsure whether the public are actually the ones who are aware of this. I think it's only cops and those who have been recent victims of crime for serious acquisitive crime that actually know this. And it's wrong that we fail victims, and that's when they actually have their eyes open to the current state of policing.
You're right about the police responses to the various reports that have come out over the years. It's like that scene from Pirates of the Caribbean. All went over to one side of the ship, then all went over to the other side of the ship, and then all went over, and eventually the ship capsizes. And that's kind of where we are. We've been running backwards and forwards, and the ship's capsizing.
Yeah, and a lot of it has been knee-jerk, hasn't it?
I think this report is a bit of an embarrassment for chief constables because the majority of them have been fairly silent.
This is true. HMIC FRS, the Inspectorate of Constabulary, is saying this is a problem, and it's right. But at least very basic, a member of the public saying, somebody has stolen my stuff. I don't have security in my possessions. Somebody can steal my car, can burgle my house. And the police response is, here's a crime number. And we don't get to them for 3 days. We miss the opportunities for forensics. We miss the opportunities for crime prevention advice. We miss the opportunities to secure evidence and a first-hand account and find out a little bit about, you know, basics, how long you've been out of the house, what's the point of entry, get a decent MO, decent modus operandi so you know how it's been committed. Get a CSI in. It's a reasonable time before the forensics are washed away, brushed away, tidied away. We miss so much.
Let me ask you a question then, Richard. As I know you two are both experienced detectives. You as a detective and then a supervisor of uniformed officers. In your day, when you went to a burglary or a stealing from motor vehicles, how long did you spend on that job?
I would say probably in the order of an hour, maybe more than an hour. You're talking with the victim. You're getting the background to the crime. You're getting as much detail as you can about what it is that's been stolen, serial numbers, stuff like that. So you're getting a good crime report for the property that's been stolen. You're looking in detail as to what the entry was, whether there was ransacking, was it all rooms, just when did it occur, was the tools used at the point of entry. So again, you've got a quality MO so that somebody analysing it later may be able to link crimes on a common method of entry, for example. That's
analysing the tool marks.
Yes, well, like that. When you call back to report it, there is stuff for CSI. There's apparent, you know, point of entry finger marks. There's foot marks. There's tool marks. Yeah, all of that stuff.
So the next question I've got then is, how long ago do you think you were able to offer that service?
I could still offer it sporadically when I was a supervisor. Mm-hmm. I could still write off a team, but whether they'd have the experience to do all that quality work and put together a proper crime report, I wasn't always sure. But the problem I would have is that I'd start my shift with 20 bobbies. And let's say I started my shift 7 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. By 8:30, I was all in. I had no bobbies left. Nothing left to deploy.
Okay. So for you to be able to give that quality of service, you've said, of spending an hour, how long ago do you think you could do that on 80% of cases?
I was a supervisor for about 6 years. I was never able to do that.
If we think back then, 7, 8, 10 years, as a bobby on the section, how many vulnerability calls did you go to per shift?
Maybe the example I could give you is, and I think we've said this previously, haven't we, when I was in uniform, if I had to section somebody in public, the 136 Mental Health Act, once a month, if I was unlucky. Now there's shifts doing it, there's 4 or 5, a shift times that by 3.
And I think that's the point I'm getting to. Things overtake, don't they? And prioritised incidents, your grade 1 must get there within 15 minutes, threat to life type incidents. Your grade 2 get there within an hour, and grade 3, 72 hours. Burglary is a very impactful crime to people, and it's a quality of life issue for people, and it isolates people in their own homes because it's the fear factor of existing in your own home. But we can't quantify that into a threat to life grading, and it becomes grade 3, we've got to get there within 72 hours. And the person on the bridge or person with other vulnerability issues or mental health issues, which rightly is important for the establishment, and I mean NHS, police, everybody, the people who protect and serve, if you will, to deal with. But that will always supersede the burglaries, and that's why we can't give that service anymore.
I mean, we see it in the ambulance service now, don't we? I always thought that the first time that somebody would die because the ambulance didn't get there in time, there'd be uproar. But it's a commonplace event now, and people, the ambulance can't get to people having heart attacks and strokes. We all know that there's that, you know, that treatment that needs to be given within the hour. They're not getting there because they're sat at hospital with goodness knows what, and there's no ambulances to go. They're having their own problems, I suppose. Richard, there was two things that you said which struck out to me, and you mentioned call handlers. Call handlers are asking specific questions now, and they're making the decision on whether to send an officer or whether to send scenes of crime. There's always something for scenes of crime, always, no matter how small. And the other thing, and Mick Barton mentioned it, didn't he? He analysed the health of his area by two crimes, burglary and stealing from motor vehicles, and that showed the health of the area. Going back to when I was an officer in uniform, we had a burglars on. Every man and his dog, or including the dog, would be there. We'd contain the scene, and usually it's one arrested 5-10 minutes later. Now, as you say, we take the details, get a crime number, and maybe somebody will come and see you in the near future.
And that's because the model of what policing is has moved from being concerned primarily with criminality to being concerned primarily with vulnerability.
And to be fair to Andy Cook, he has actually mentioned that. He mentioned that at the Home Office Select Committee, where he said the police are dealing 70-80% with vulnerability. And I think the subheading to this report of finding time for crime is big, because he's aware that policing only finite resources, you know, what do you want us to deal with?
And that is why it's becoming an issue now, because that is filtered through to government, who then brief the newspapers, and now it's becoming an issue. I mean, we're still getting bashed, but let's face it, it's not entirely the police's fault that we've had to go down this road.
No, rip the plaster off, lay everything bare and say to the public, this is the current state of policing, this is where we're starting from. Come with us on the journey now.
Well, I think the inspectors, looking through the report, identified a few things. They identified missed opportunities to identify and catch offenders. I think we've kind of discussed that, haven't we? 71% of people weren't getting crime advice when they were subject to a victim of crime. So, you know, there's usual things. If there's a footprint, put a bin lid over it, that sort of stuff.
It doesn't need to be, you know, CSI Miami. it just needs an officer who has some basic awareness, has perhaps been with more experienced officers. For myself, I went out my probation with CSI, but I also went out on my CID detachment. It used to be CID would visit all burglaries 30 years ago. That hasn't happened for decades. But I went out with a detective doing the burglary visits and sat and listened to the right questions being asked in the right order and a good assessment of the crime scene and a good assessment for the MO. And you learn from that. You go out with somebody that knows their business and watch them going about their business. Even if it's just for 2 or 3 days, you learn enough so that you can repeat that quality of care for yourself.
If a burglary went on the books, we're swinging the lead here a bit, aren't we? The DI would be wanting to know what was going on, what's happening with this, who's got it, who's the OIC, right, Constable Bradshaw, who in CID have you spoken to and, you know, what's going on with it? And there'd be a bit of heat because it was dealt with as a high priority. Because it was a high priority to the public.
But there was no Section 136s. There were very few. I can't remember them happening in my first decade. I just can't remember them being a feature of policing at all.
No, because I don't think people's mental health had come to a head because it was being dealt with in the community by mental health teams, which have all been got rid of. So it was managed. And I think fewer people were at crisis point then than they are now because of nobody to turn to.
The first time I dealt with someone on the other side of the bridge in crisis was when I was on the ARV, and that was 2 or so years in. So I don't think I dealt with someone in crisis, as in about to do something really bad, for the first couple of years.
I did about 5 years in uniform, all told, before I went into CID. I had one during all that time, and that was somebody that had taken some pills and was outside.
And any new cop now listening to us say that would find that absolutely incredulous to think, hang on a minute, you went through your entire probation without dealing with someone in the peak of crisis.
Police have always been responsible for somebody's welfare. It's written into the oath, isn't it? You know, preserve life. But since the responsibility, it seems, or unassumed responsibility, has been the police's.
A decade ago when I was nightjacking and blogging, I coined the phrase, the paramilitary social workers of last resort. Yeah. And that was a decade ago, and I saw it coming. I like to think I saw it coming. And that's where we were then.
I think you underestimated just how...
Possibly I did.
Just how much it does impact on us. Well, these next two items that they identified were massive for me, and it's lack of investigative capacity due to the national detective shortage and inexperience. And just as important, it highlighted that investigations were not being effectively supervised. A third of those cases had insufficient supervision.
Really doesn't surprise me. Again, spent 5-6 years supervising. As a sergeant on response, I'd start my shift at 7, and by 8:30 I was all in. No officers left. We haven't got anybody to deploy to, even if it had been put as a big, you know, sort of grade 1 or grade 2. And there were other things that had already employed mine, whether it be bed watches, whether it be searching for a vulnerable missing from home but at high risk, whether it be threats to kill over the internet or whatever, all of that sort of stuff that mine would have to get involved with. So I'd have nobody to deploy to it anyway if I wanted to. And I did want to. But I couldn't. And it's because there are other things that are graded more importantly that you have to deploy your officers to, and you've got no choice in that.
It's a vicious circle now, isn't it? Because of all the vulnerability that we deal with, cops are lacking experience because they're not being able to get to the burglaries. So therefore, they're not getting experience of investigating them. And so then that kind of flows through, doesn't it? So when these cops decide to go on CID, they've no foundations to base their experiences on.
They're great social workers. Aren't they? You can deal with vulnerability.
All day, every day, and document it and take the right steps.
Yeah, so it's nothing against the cops themselves. It's just the fact that they've not been exposed to it. And I've said before, if you can teach someone on their initial course 100 different things, but if you don't expose them to it, the learning's not going to be embedded, is it? You will get good cops, you know, really enthusiastic, proactive, going on to CID, and they just don't have the basics needed because they've just not been exposed to it.
And that feeds through to the supervision then, because you've got police officers inexperienced in dealing with acquisitive crime who then become supervisors that have got inexperienced of not dealing with that. And one of the things the report said, obviously insufficient supervision sets a blueprint for poor standards. But I would take that one further now. I would say that it's now set a culture of not investigating crimes, with just doing the minimum, and that has become the standard now.
If we built a system where burglary goes to 3-day response, and we're saying burglary, theft generally...
Unofficially,
that's not that important to us, because what's important gets done quickly. But there's other riskier stuff comes ahead of it, and you're right. when you get a supervisor that doesn't really know the way around investigating a burglary, how are they going to set actions for the officer to complete? How are they going to review the quality of the investigation if they don't know what a quality investigation looks like and feels like?
And I think one of the other things, the report said the police overlooked the complexity and harm caused by serious acquisitive crime, and we're all guilty of it until we're shook out of our complacency by a nasty job, but we forget how victims feel.
I've been a victim of burglary before I joined the job, and we moved house very shortly after that. Couldn't stay in the house, moved elsewhere. That was the impact it had.
Yeah, the impact is massive, isn't it? But the problem is, it's more long-lasting, and we can't grade that, we can't quantify that, we can't put a percentage on that. So therefore, in times gone by in policing, quote, it's not really mattered, because we can't put a red or a green on it, because the initial risk isn't threat to life, so therefore we're not going to it initially. But it's a long-lasting impact of it, like you say. If you speak to most members of the public and say, what's your experience of policing? You might get, I was burgled 20 years ago and this didn't happen, that didn't happen, and all the rest of it. My parents were burgled, what would it be now, 30 years ago, where a family heirloom, a watch, was taken, and it's still remembered.
Going back to when there was decisions made to start effectively cutting policing budgets because we had a Home Office that thought it had crime beaten, all the lines were going down. Thinking was, I think, well, we probably don't need as many police officers now because we've got crime beaten. And the reason crime was going down was because there was enough police officers and we were bearing down on crime, would be my contention.
And we were proactive.
We were.
As well as reactive. We were proactive. So you were detecting one to save five others.
You don't get rid of pilots just because the plane's got an autopilot function, do you?
Absolutely right.
You still need them when it goes wrong.
Yeah. And now the figures are going the wrong way again. And we have this, 20,000 new policing.
I was just looking at some of the figures, and it nicely brings us on to what you were just saying. 6.6 people were charged with offences from serious acquisitive crime, which is pretty poor. I mean,
it's extremely poor.
6.6%.
Yeah. Yes. I was talking to a friend, all right, albeit she was flying squad. I know it can be intel led, but 30 years ago, they were working on a 25% detection rate, which is pretty good. But what was more interesting, and I can't really understand why, that evidential difficulties rears its ugly head again as an outcome on a crime. 20.4%, the victim didn't support any action. Now, I was a bit surprised by that.
I'm a bit surprised by that as well. It's one of those things that strikes me as, we want to just get this offence closed off because we haven't got time to do anything further with it. Are you all right with just a crime number? Whichever way it's done, it doesn't strike me as right.
But the big one. No suspect identified, 39.4%.
Yeah.
Ouch.
The other big one for me was offences taken into consideration. I think it was 0.1.
Yeah, well, who does TICs anymore?
Offences taken into consideration, back when we had reliable forensic visits and forensic recoveries at burglary, one of the things you say to somebody is, well, we've got this one, which you're admitting because you've banged your eyes. We're still in the process of investigating these four others, which have got exactly the same MO, happened at the same time, and all happened within 200 yards of where you live.
But they look like the same tool marks, it looks like the same footwear marks.
Yeah, exactly. Would you like to talk us about having some offences taken into consideration? And if that's right and it's reliable and they can tell you something about it and they wanted to do the TICs, offences taken into consideration, you would then at least be able to say to the victim, yeah, we know who did your burglary. We've detected it. They've asked for it to be taken into consideration when they go to court, but it looks like TICs have died.
But those golden hour tasks and CSI, crime scene investigators, we're not collecting that evidence. You've got a picture of a jigsaw, but you've no pieces in the box. You're not going to be able to do it.
You're on the front foot, and we're not on the front foot anymore with this stuff.
So is there a disposal? Is there an outcome there, Dave, that says we didn't have time to investigate?
No. I'm sure it's perhaps written in another way.
Evidential difficulties.
Yes.
Not enough cops.
Not enough evidence because not enough cops.
All right, well, let's not slag the police too much. We mentioned Mr. Dave Thompson earlier, who was the Chief Constable of West Midlands Police, and you rightly said that he'd put a bit of a thread on Twitter. And the main thrust of his argument, apart from the fact, yes, he did agree with the report and everything that was in it, was that the upshot of it says, well, everything can't be a priority. And he said, well, look, in September 2021, you said you slated the police because we weren't looking at violence against women and you pulled the service over to the vulnerability side. Now you want us to go back to crime. And I can see the point he's trying to make, that everything does seem to be a priority. And it goes back to your example, Richard, of Pirates of the Caribbean and everybody's running from one side of the ship to the other.
Well, it's right. But what I say with Mr. Thompson, is violence against women and girls something the police should be very interested in and looking at? Yes. Is serious acquisitive crime something we should be looking at? Yes. Is providing overflow capacity for managing vulnerability for mental health services and social services? Well, no, that's not so much prime police business. You can make it police business by telling us about your vulnerability and that you can't manage it at the moment. You can certainly do that. And it may well be that those social services and mental health services don't have the capacity any more than we have. So we've got a little bit more than them because we're 24/7. Because we police the 5 p.m. to 9 a.m. gap and we do the weekends. But is violence against women and girls something we should look at? Yeah, absolutely it is. It's core business. And is serious acquisitive crime? Yes, that's core business for policing. Because we're the police service, the police forces. That's what we should be doing. So is it legitimate, Mr. Thompson, to be told, sharpen up your act on violence against women and girls? Yes. Is it for him to say you need better at serious acquisitive crime? Yes. Is it then also beholden on us to say, and somehow, and this is the problem, and this is what this report from HMIC doesn't address, somehow you've got to get your head out of the noose of dealing with other people's vulnerability demand. And I don't see a way out of that noose until the other bodies that are involved are able to manage their own demand effectively. And they can't, because they've been hammered the same as we have.
I think when you turn up for your shift and the jobs that the priority for you at that moment, a Monday morning or a Monday afternoon or whatever, is to save life. And when you run out of cops and you haven't moved from that category of saving life, because there's more lives to save than there are cops you've got turning on, the rest of it ain't going to get looked at.
It's not good enough that we have X amount of officers that can only deal with some of the priorities when we really need to be dealing with all the priorities. And the best example I can give you is you've got two fields. One needs, the grass needs cutting, the other one needs digging, but you've only the choice of a lawnmower or a spade. It's one or the other. And that's the problem we've got. And we just keep flitting from one to the other, don't we? And we need enough officers to deal with all the priorities that are our responsibility. And I just hope that by dealing with crime as much as we should be, there are other people that do come under our area of responsibility that perhaps maybe start to get forgotten about.
If you were a chief constable with these reports in, you'd still be looking at your demand and saying, I have these code ones and these code twos. There's nothing I can do about those. I have to make sure that there is sufficient resource to service those. I think I've kind of got it about right. I'm servicing those. We're not failing many ones and twos. There aren't that many people dying on our watch, or, you know, ideally nobody dying on our watch for lack of police.
Yeah, but are they R1s or 2s? You know what I mean? Is it a policing grade 1? Is it, like Dave said before, is it your burglary in progress?
It's not. It's, here's a lump of risk and risk to life. Please manage it.
I'm trying to think, and I can't remember. Before we had 1s, 2s and 3s, how do we grade calls? Obviously, we always have the 999 emergency calls, but how many categories do we have? I'm struggling to remember now.
No, we had grades. We had five grades. Oh, I'm going off the top of my head now. There's five grades, isn't there? Grade 1, 15 minutes. Grade 2, 1 hour. Grade 3, 72 hours. Grade 4 was it advice over the phone? Grade 5, no deployment.
Way back in the past, when I had to do my compulsory 2 weeks in the Blackburn control room at Northgate, I seem to remember it's kind of dispatcher's choice, because you had a dispatcher and they were being fed all the logs that were coming in from your call takers, and they were looking at it and going, right, this needs next. And there was like a big whiteboard in front of them with where their patrols were and what the patrols were doing. And it sort of processed through one experienced set of hands that had a feel for what needed doing.
It was local control rooms in local areas who knew the patch. So you might get, for example, two similar offences in different areas of the patch, but one was more impactive than the other. One was, I don't know, a volume crime or something, which might just tip the balance for the dispatcher. Well, that's because the dispatcher worked that area all the time and knew the area, knew the cops, knew the people, knew the jobs.
And you'd have a dedicated dispatcher, different sort of dispatcher, if you will. I remember I worked at Darwin, little market town in Lancashire. And my dispatcher on that team there had worked Darwin all his life, and he'd come inside, basically. He had an inside job, so he didn't have to go on foot patrol anymore. But he had a mental map of Darwin that was absolutely flawless. And if you had a disturbed burglary, for example, he would be directing patrols to where the rat runs, the getaway routes were, because he knew
like
it.
He took the role of bronze commander, didn't he, without being at the scene?
Because he had that superb local knowledge. if there was no description of the offenders, you didn't bother shouting up as you sometimes get these days, is there any description of the offenders? If there was no description, that's because there wasn't one. Because if there was one, he'd have passed it. And there was that trust in your team. That's gone. Do we have to go to centralised control rooms? Yeah, we probably did, because there's issues around scale and money.
I remember, you know, back in the late 90s when you had your scratch pads and, you know, and the day, sometimes I had to do comms. It was a little country police station, but it was literally, you pick the phone, 999 phone call, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, you start taking the details. And then whilst you're holding the phone in one hand, you get all the radio the other, patrols can you start making before you'd even got details. You know, and there seemed to be a lot more, I don't know, more efficiency, shall we say.
But I guess the hard fact is we're not operating like we did back when I worked at Darwin.
No, we're not.
It's changed beyond recognition. And
I'm not saying we should go back to pen and paper, but there's pros and cons, isn't
there? We've got the systems we've got, and this report highlights where we've taken the foot off the gas, perhaps.
Yeah, and there's the demands on the cops and the dispatchers and call takers and stuff is very, very high. So when they aren't doing that our golden service we explained before, it's because there's another grade one to go to or a grade two to go to, and they're getting mithered to say, what are you doing? You've been there 15 minutes. And they feel that they need to break off or that there isn't correct forensic advice given at certain jobs. Because there's a wall board right in front of them saying there's 15 calls waiting, and if there's a 999 call waiting, it rings like a big old-fashioned bell in your ear.
And throughout the shift, over the radio coming in as a supervisor, you will hear, I'm sorry, Alpha 50, I'm going to have to break you from the job that you're at. There's a code 2 about to fail, and I need you to go to that. And then you've got a choice as supervisor. Do you step in and go, I'm sorry, your grade 2 is going to fail, I need him to stay there? Or do you say,
for a long time,
what is that grade 2?
We were, because we were figures orientated, and figures do have a purpose, but it was like, you know, on the pain of death, do we fail to attend a grade 2 or a grade 1? Well, and we were our own worst enemies, weren't we? Because we were basically hiding a problem that there wasn't enough of us.
Because that's the high priority stuff, isn't it? The grade 1s and grade 2. And we said, right, we need to get to these because that's where the immediacy of risk and harm is. And that's why your burglaries, your stealing from motor vehicles, which weren't happening now, got into the 3s. And if we can't do 1s and 2s, grade 1s and 2s, we're not going to do a grade 3. And that's why our response as a service countrywide is massively lacking on serious acquisitive crime. Grading of what's important is the here and now. The grading of the public is the long-lasting effect on them and their communities.
No, that's a good point. That's a very good point.
And it is going to affect confidence in policing. If it's around that, when you get stuff stolen from you, cops are rubbish. You just get a crime report, get speech to you on the phone. They never come round. They never send CSI. That's corrosive. People are not going to feel that we're doing anything core function stuff.
Yeah. Well, I can't help thinking that we're going to be heading towards a perfect storm with everything else that's going on in the world. Try not to be too pessimistic. I mean, everybody's banging on about the hot weather at the moment and there's apocalyptic headlines of this, that and the other. But all I say is, what a wonderful summer we're having.
Isn't it good? Yeah. But I can't wait for the thunderstorms to come. Clear the air a little bit.
One last question I do have. Is there such thing as Her Majesty's Inspector of Mental Health Provision?
That's a good question. I don't know.
And do they have reports on different areas of their business that they are achieving or requiring development, which then gets lead articles on the 6 o'clock news and the 10 o'clock news?
Perhaps that's something we could look at.
Perhaps that's something, if it did happen, perhaps there'd be a lot more scrutiny around it about actually, and that report might actually say, I'm just guessing, that in fact other services are doing your job.
We got close to, not a golden age, but a time when things were looking to be heading a little bit better for us, around the time that Inspector Michael Brown, mental health cop,
yes,
as he was known, went to the College of Policing and started doing some work around policing and mental health, which he's not doing anymore, unfortunately, I would say, and had a wonderful website which was available, which I used to put to any other supervisor that would listen. If you get a knotty mental health problem at 3 a.m, straight to the mental health cop website, because whatever problem you think is unique and strange, he's looked at it,
yes,
he's thought it through, and he's come up with something that's NDM compliant that you can rely on when you're dealing with it, and what you must do and what you must not do and what you can and what you can't do. And at that point, I thought, you know what? probably from the efforts of one officer, were starting to grip this problem. But somehow, once the college got involved, once national policing got involved, it all started getting a bit quicksilvery and slipping through the fingers, and it wasn't just quite as straightforward as you might hope it would be. For me, it hid the fact that actually there wasn't anybody else there to take over the job from us.
Is it the fact of it was very, very much a painful truth
for
those in power?
Yeah. And,
we weren't willing at that point to actually expose that and shine a light on it.
And tricky for our partners that sometimes after spinning the NDM through the mental health cop scenario, your answer is, no, sorry, can't help you. Click. Yeah. That didn't go down very well. But our vulnerability, yeah, I know. But if you look at the law and you look at what we can do and what you can do, it stays with you.
I remember a report a good few years ago about the eternal problem of shift patterns in the police, and we've never got it right yet. And I know a certain force employed an outside agency to do a report. This is our responsibility. What do we need in terms of officer numbers and shift patterns to service that responsibility? And basically the report said, well, you're going to need A, B and C, of which the force neither, and the report was put in the bottom shelf of a filing cabinet because they didn't like what they were being told. What you want is you can't deliver.
There's a gap.
Yes. Quite a big gap. And it brings us on to royal commissions, doesn't it? I mean, people have been banging on for years about wanting a royal commission into policing. I suspect they probably, it'll be the same thing. They'll get the answers they don't want to hear.
Well, my last Radio Night Jack thing, you know, was about Home Office wanting a 12-month report into police productivity led by Sir Stephen House. And it's another 12-month report. It's another kicking the can 12 months down the road. And I think a royal commission, for what it's worth, would still just be kicking the can down the road as long as the Home Office are playing what the Home Office are playing.
And it's another excuse to kick the cops in the nuts as well every 12 months, isn't it?
Sure. And if you kick a can down the road, as I say, it's still a can. It's still in the road. In 12 months, it'll still be there. Do you kick it again or do you pick it up?
Well, thankfully our nuts aren't in that can anymore, but we're still quite annoyed about the fact. So thanks for listening, and until the next podcast, take care.
Take care, folks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. This podcast is in partnership with Policing TV, the leading policing media channel. So until the next time, on the next podcast, take care.